From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away. I'm Brooke Gladstone. After an unusually grim week in an endless series, one in which a young black father shot in the back by a cop in Kenosha, Wisconsin, in front of his three kids, that moment and nothing else was captured on video.
They shot my son 7 times like he didn't matter. But my son matters. He's a human being, and he matters.
The incident prompted action by athletes in the NBA, the Milwaukee Bucks responding this week with an unprecedented one-day strike.
And it spilled over to Major League Baseball because the Milwaukee Brewers and Cincinnati Reds have also decided not to play tonight.
It spurred the sudden departure of an NBA commentator from the set in what seemed like a moment of anguish and solidarity.
As a black man, as a former player, I think it's best for me to support the players and just not be here tonight.
Yeah, I just don't feel comfortable.
It ignited protests in Kenosha's streets, which spurred a gun-toting, Trump-loving teen to join other armed vigilantes responding to what they heard as a call to stop the violence, mostly against property. The kid killed two and injured one. You may think it's a bit gratuitous, even unfair, to drop the president's name here. But if you do, it's because you didn't watch the RNC this week. You missed the McCluskeys of elite St. Louis, who in June stood sentry in front of their marble palazzo and brandished firearms at Black Lives Matter protesters marching past. The McCluskeys were charged with a felony and were featured in RNC primetime, hailed as heroes. You miss the lines drawn sharp as razors between Americans, whether slinging guns or throwing shade. And lucky you avoided the deep and dizzying disorientation that viewers of the bizarro vision of the bizarro president experienced night after ever-loving night.
And I say very modestly that I have done more for the African-American community than any president since Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, like bizarro Superman. Superman's exact opposite, who lives in the backwards bizarro world. Up is down, down is up. He says hello when he leaves, goodbye when he arrives.
It's not a new analogy, but I really felt its ludicrous force watching the RNC this week. Apparently, the pandemic is over.
It was awful. Health and economic impacts were tragic, but presidential leadership came swiftly and effectively.
The nation is a hellscape.
Anarchists have been flooding our streets. Small businesses across America, many of them minority-owned, are being torched by mobs.
It's a hellscape, and it will become a hellscape if Joe Biden becomes president.
Just imagine if the so-called peaceful demonstrators in the streets were in charge of every lever of power in the U.S. government. Just think of that.
Child man, listen. Bizarro have best words.
Bizarro's telescopic vision allows him to see a short distance behind him rather than a long distance in front. His microscopic vision makes objects, say pandemics, violations of the Hatch Act, smaller.
Bizarro vision make you happy.
It's nauseating, literally. Trying to find a footing in a world where up is down and wrong is right. Watching the convention, James Fallows of The Atlantic felt it too.
There were these speeches saying, we welcome black people, we welcome immigrants, we welcome women, we are inclusive, Donald Trump is nice. And that was at odds with the gun-toting couple from St. Louis saying they're coming to get you. And the speakers saying that Donald Trump was the bastion of Western civilization, which was under siege on all fronts. So that was the conflict the Republicans had of what they were saying to the base and how they hoped to invite people in.
It struck me that it was to reassure white people that they wouldn't be racist if they voted for him.
Reassure women also that they wouldn't be anti-feminist or anti-woman if they decided to go with Trump. What they showed and did was more powerful than what they said.
Do you think that the convention's new virtual format actually encouraged the president to violate the Hatch Act? I mean, to blatantly break the law? You're not supposed to use your office directly for politics.
Every night, things that had not been done before were done, including a Secretary of State weighing in from Jerusalem. The Hatch Act applies to everybody else in the government, but not to the president. Everything a president does is implicitly political. Previous presidents have tried to stay on one side of the line. They haven't done actual explicitly political events from on the White House property. And so Donald Trump that's one of many norms that he has not observed. And maybe if he had to go to Charlotte, he would not have done so many events from the Rose Garden or inside the White House.
So how do you think journalists are covering these different conventions?
Probably for the public, it means there's more concentration on what is actually being said and signaled and conveyed.
A little more fact-checking?
Real-time fact-checking, you know, trying to keep up. Most stalwartly and valiantly, Daniel Dale on CNN.
It's not just big things like this broad revisionism on the response to the pandemic. It's little inaccuracy, carelessness. We had someone, Laura Trump, cite a fake Abraham Lincoln quote tonight.
We're seeing a distillation of the challenge our comrades have had for the last 3+ years, which is, if you judge things by normal standards, you will sound one-sided. If you say they're lying 100 times as much in one of these conventions than the other, you will be factually accurate, but all of your fair and balanced instincts make you think, well, that sounds unbalanced. So that's the challenge that even now I think most of our colleagues are having.
In The Atlantic, you write about cool media and hot media in the Marshall McLuhan sense, and suggested that it pretty well summed up the styles of the Democratic and Republican conventions this year.
At the Republican convention, the staple shot was a public figure standing at the podium and orating at a crowd that didn't happen to be there. Like in old conventions, you'd shout to emphasize certain points, et cetera, et cetera. So that was sort of the old-fashioned, hot, sweaty, in-your-face rhetoric. Whereas the Democrats, recognizing they did not have a crowd, the more representative one was either Barack or Michelle Obama, very quietly looking at the camera and talking directly to you.
You can give our democracy new meaning. You can take it to a better place. You're the missing ingredient.
It was like FDR in a fireside chat over the radio to people during the Depression, that kind of intimacy.
My friends, my enemies, my Daily Mail, bring to me reports of what you are thinking and hoping.
McLuhan said that cool media are those that need the participation of users due to their low definition.
Yes, and so I will stipulate that Marshall McLuhan, who came up with this categorization long ago in Understanding Media, I think in the mid-1960s, mm-hmm. his definitions of the terms may be at slight odds with the way I'm using them.
Yeah, I always had trouble with his definitions, actually.
The way I think of hot media is something that is coming at you. The best representation we've seen in the last 10 days was Kimberly Guilfoyle.
President Trump believes in you. He emancipates and lifts you up to live your American dream.
That was something that resembled only two other parts of modern discourse. One is Sunday morning preachers, and the other is some 3 a.m. infomercial guy.
The Bass-O-Matic?
Yeah. And maybe the MyPillow guy has been the rhetoric coach for the whole convention.
10 years ago, I invented MyPillow. It took me 2 years to develop because I wanted to have everything you would ever want in a pillow.
Whereas a cooler approach to me is something that invites you in rather than yells at you.
In the article you wrote in The Atlantic, you hearken back to Norman Mailer, who saw John Kennedy's ascension at the 1960 Democratic National Convention as a moment when the cool invaded the political sphere. He was, Mailer said, unlike any politician who'd ever run for president in the history of the land. And if elected, he would come to power in a year when America was in danger of drifting into a profound decline.
The victory we seek in November will not be easy. We know that in our hearts. We know that our opponent will invoke the name of Abraham Lincoln on behalf of their candidate.
Similar to the poise of a fine boxer, quick with his hands, neat in his timing, and 2 feet from his corner when the bell ended the round. There was an elusive detachment to everything he did.
I was contrasting that to, say, Hubert Humphrey or Lyndon Johnson, politicians of Kennedy's time who left nothing behind. They would grab you by the lapels. They would get so close in your face, you would feel their spittle in the days before that had a mortal danger to it. So I thought that the Democrats couldn't do a sort of hot, sweaty convention because of the virus, although Republicans have tried. And so I thought they really leapt to embrace the cool style.
Have you thought about which style is more effective for what purpose?
So I'll give an illustration of an early touch in the Democratic convention that I hadn't expected before the instant I saw it. But then after it was over, I thought, well, of course, that's the right way to try to do things. And that was the roll call of states.
Yeah, that was really entrancing.
And that's been sort of the most formulaic balderdash part of conventions over the years, where you'll go to the floor and the great state of Oklahoma, home of Will Rogers and, you know, the Tulsa oil wells, whatever, cast all of its 12 votes. And they were talking about their states, but it was all almost campy. And they were sort of outdoing each other in ridiculousness. And there was a touch of that with the Democrats, especially with the calamari guy from Rhode Island.
The calamari comeback state of Rhode Island casts one vote for Bernie Sanders and 34 votes for the next president, Joe Biden.
Without having to spell it out, it gave you the idea that this is a big country, and it's a different country, and it's a beautiful country, and that people are connected to where they're from.
Half a day, T-Roll, and hello from paradise, the Northern Mariana Islands. We may be far away, but we're American citizens.
That roll call did not have to have a single thing saying e pluribus unum, but its entire message was conveying that. And I thought it would reinforce people who are already Democratic partisans, I think, but also it might invite some people to say, this looks more like the country I'd like to rebuild.
The Democratic convention didn't have huge ratings by any means, but they were still better than the Republican convention. So that probably bothers Trump.
you think?
And the Democratic convention had a more laid-back approach. Biden's speech at 24 minutes was one of the shortest acceptance speeches in recent memory. Fundamentally, though, does it matter?
There is an existential question of whether anything matters in politics now, whether national politics is all simply tribe, resentment, and identity. But here's a thought experiment of things that might have mattered. You mentioned that Biden's acceptance speech was the shortest in modern conventions. I think that's because this was a profoundly TV event as opposed to a live event. And if he'd spoken for an hour, nobody would have kept watching. But imagine the world we would live in right now if during that speech, Biden had had some physical problem, if he'd stumbled going up to the stage. Imagine if he had seemed to have lost his way in the text. Imagine if he'd had said something that was just embarrassing or wrong. And so I think his speech was actually quite important. Now Trump's attack is, oh, Biden must have been taking some kind of performance-enhancing drug. That mattered. And I think there's nobody who will say that his or her vote was changed by seeing Joe Biden give a coherent speech, seeing Jill Biden tell a story of her life. But a million things go into these feelings, and I bet those will be some of the million.
Jim, thank you very much.
Brooke, it is a great pleasure to speak with you once again.
James Fallows is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Coming up, pandemic delusions in the nation's higher ed. This is On the Media.